Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, and don't call it unless we ask for calls, because we have with us this evening Bob Chapman, and Bob publishes the International Forecaster. He's one of the few people that have been at this game longer than I have, having started in the late 1950s, and he's a very, very efficient observer of what's happening financially. Now, if you look and see really what's going on in our country, we find everything is changing. Last evening, why they announced that a large spice manufacturer plant over in Salinas closing down, 400 people are going to lose their jobs. We find that so many of the companies, the major companies that have been providing wonderful benefits for their employees, the retirement, the health care benefits when they do retire, we're finding GM is beginning to cut back on those benefits and cut back on their pensions. IBM is going to freeze their pensions. Motorola, Verizon. So many of the major companies are beginning to cut back on those promises that they've made. And people who've been expecting to spend their golden years living comfortably may not be anywhere as near as comfortable as they thought. More and more of our factories are leaving America. More and more of our jobs are leaving America. Even many of our medical situations, such as, reading x-rays. Why, they can read those x-rays over in India for about a quarter of what they can read them for here. And about 20% of our x-rays now from our hospitals are being sent to India to be read. And then, of course, they can get the report back in relatively few minutes. Our architectural jobs are going overseas. Certainly many of our telephone answering service jobs are going overseas. Even legal services are going overseas, where people can get the legal work done over in India for a quarter what they can get done here, and then they simply turn the research over to a lawyer here who takes it to court, or maybe it'll even be an Indian lawyer working here. Who knows? Well, anyway, with that as the background, our guest is Bob Chapman. Hi, Bob. How are you doing tonight?
Well, pretty good.
Well, now, what's happening to the dollar? You know, the dollar's really made an amazing recovery here over the last year. Everybody thought it was in a free fall. It was down, almost to 80 compared with what it had been, up about $1.26, down to 80. And then it's sort of really risen rather dramatically since then. But the last couple of days, why it seems to be falling. Is this just a temporary thing? Do you think it's going to continue up to 100, or do you think it's going to start to fall again?
I think it will fall again. The dollar got up to around 92, 93. It's around 88.5 or 9 in that area versus the euro. It got up to 136.6 and had a low of around 115. It's currently trading at 120.5 approximately. So in the last several weeks, the dollar has gone down against other currencies, and I think that'll continue. I don't know that it's going to go any further in this year to the downside than it did the year before last. But what's developed in the meantime is that people who are professionals and money managers and so on, they've decided that they really don't want to be in any of the currencies.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with our friend Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking to Bob about what's happening to the dollar. Certainly, what we've done is America has been in a wonderful position for many years. We've been able to print dollars and just create them out of nothing and then give them to the rest of the world, and we've been able to get all their products here. We're the largest consumer in the world. We're consuming about 80% of the various goods that are produced throughout the world, but how long is that going to be able to continue? How long it will be before these other countries are beginning to look at those dollars and say, hey, what are these redeemable in? And, of course, all they're redeemable in is whatever they can buy here in the way of our factories or our property, things of that sort.
Well, going back to what we were just talking about, professionals have begun leaving all currencies as much as they can and moving into gold. The reason why is it's the currency that nobody has any loans against or anything like that. It's a pure currency. And that's one of the reasons that gold has been as strong as it has, over $500 an ounce. And so with that said, the mosaic that backs the dollar is being ripped asunder. You have enormous current account deficit. You have an enormous budget deficit. You have enormous personal debt. You have government debt that's now reached its limit again of $8.14 trillion. They're going to have to add to that. The overall commitment for debt is about $52 trillion. You then have a recovery which probably produced about $2.6 million jobs in 5 years, and 70% of them were jobs that paid under $10 an hour. You have a recovery that should have produced 10 million jobs. That's due to offshoring and outsourcing, which you were just talking about. And you have a bubble in the real estate market. You have pension funds that are in serious trouble, and many companies are dumping or freezing their commitments to their employees. And many of the companies that are doing that are very successful, have excellent profits, but it's the style, and it's an opportunity to...
Hold that thought right there for just a moment, Bob, and we'll be right back. Well, our friend Bob Chapman is just saying that really what we were saying, and that is many of the major corporations are simply either freezing or dumping their pension obligation to employees, and it's not because these companies are not making good profits. They're making excellent profits. At least, of course, we're not talking about General Motors, but we're talking about IBM and some of the other companies. But as long as everybody else is doing, why not doing it? After all, if they can undercut their employees, they'll make a lot more money, and their stock will go up higher. And, of course, the corporate executives that get all their stock options and hold all the stock are going to do very, very well. But this is going to create tremendous resentment, I would think, down the line from the average individual, won't it?
Well, I think it already has. And it's going to continue and get worse. And the excuse is, well, we have to cut back in order to stay competitive. And at the bottom of all this, again, is free trade and globalization, offshoring, outsourcing. It's ripping the heart out of our economy, and it's being done deliberately. And Europe and Canada are getting hit just as hard. It's just that, you know, you don't hear about it unless you subscribe to the International Forecaster. And I see no end in sight. Corporate America simply owns government. I was shocked tonight. I watch Lou Dobbs every evening. And he came out and said, which was very surprising, that corporate America owns Congress. I mean, you don't see that in a mainline broadcast. It's the only thing that I'll watch that has any truth to it. But anyway, I think the public realizes that. They just don't know what to do about it.
Well, I think that, first, I believe in the free enterprise system. I believe in competition. But what we no longer have free enterprise, we have a monopoly capitalism, which works in concert with government, for the betterment of a very small minority of the people. And what we're really talking about is moving away from freedom towards a feudal or fascist society. And unfortunately, we have in Washington, D.C. today, some of the finest politicians that money could buy. I believe in free enterprise. We don't have free enterprise. That's the tragedy. What we need to do is get away from that. And we're moving towards a situation very soon where the corporations will rule the world. And that is the plan. That is the plan of the elite. Would you agree or disagree?
Yes, and I think when they bring it to that point, they're going to have to deal with the people. And they know that. And they'll do whatever it takes to put them down. And that's why we have the Patriot Acts. And that's why we have our government spying on us all the time. And really, spying's been going on for years. I worked in conjunction with NSA. It was many, many years ago, but I know how all that works.
You were actually in intelligence, weren't you, when you were in the military?
Yeah, that's right. And we actually, in Army counterintelligence, work for NSA. We just happen to be in the Army, as opposed to being civilian employees. And the kinds of things that we did in those days, a lot of them are done by technology today that didn't exist then. But they, as you know, they've had the echelon system for 25 years. They have been copying every message of any kind that goes through the ether during that time. Americans, everybody. And of course, they've gone many steps further, and now, just recently, the NSA has gotten caught doing what they were doing for the president and his henchmen, we'll call them. And so it's a revelation to the public. But it's been going on for years.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I don't know why they're making such a big fuss about it now. They've known it's been going on for a long period of time. But the using, of course, the threat of terrorism. Oh, my goodness, we've got to combat the wicked Osama bin Laden. That's why we've got to set up a system of monitoring and spying on every law-abiding citizen. There's not one word in the Patriot Act about Islamic terrorism. They simply redefine terrorism to those who would want to change our form of government. And, of course, that, of course, is the people in the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderbergers and the Trilateral and this corporate elite. They're the real terrorists by their own definition, but I wouldn't hold your breath until something's done about them. They want to change us from a republic into a democracy and from a democracy into a fascist society where, of course, the government works in conjunction with these people of great wealth and of course, controls us common folks.
Well, to give you a good example, I wrote a piece today, just recently. A man and his family flew from Toronto to Ixtapa in Mexico. And two F-16 fighter jets intercepted the plane outside of Ixtapa and followed it down. And they took the man and his wife and children off the plane. And the reason that they did that is that they were on the U.S. He was on the U.S. no-fly list. Now, we all know how idiotic the no-fly list is, for starters. What the Americans don't know is that every flight that goes within 300 miles of our coastline or over our country, all airlines from all countries have to submit all the information that they have that they're told to get on all the passengers so that the United States government can know if there are any or how many terrorists are on a plane. And so they knew this man was on that plane, and the reason they intercepted it the way they did was to make an issue out of it. It was staged. And what they did was they sent the family back on one plane and sent him back in another. The other plane that he was on supposedly didn't fly over the United States to Canada. I don't know how they arranged it. They must have went offshore. But anyway, they are opening up most of the mail going overseas. If they don't open it, they scan it. And the same is true with courier packages. They are also in checking people who are flying. If they go to a destination in their itinerary that the United States government doesn't like Cuba, then they won't let them come into the United States. Whether they're a foreigner or not doesn't make any difference. They'll have to find another way to get to where they're going. And so these sort of things are going on all the time. And you can trust that your phones are tapped. And you can trust that your emails are intercepted, that your site is looked at for content. And I know this because, you know, we're in the publishing business, and I change my phones every 6 months. I won't tell you on the air how I do it, and I won't tell you how I fix my computer so they can't invade them. But that's what's going on out there.
And I think it's so hard for the average individual to understand that. That's because they've never looked into the Echelon project, and it's all done by, they scan it by computer, and then they, of course, get humans to go over if there are any keywords or things like that that come up. I'm sure for some people, probably like you, Bob, they probably don't even bother with the computer. They just get somebody to watch you. Because they target specific people. For instance, it's now come out that they were actually monitoring James Bovard. He's been a guest on our program several times. He wrote a book called Body of Secrets, talking about the NSA, about one of the special government projects called Operation Northwood that had been declassified, where they were actually planning on trying to precipitate a war with Cuba by blowing up a rocket, the one that John Glenn was going to go up when he was an astronaut, and then they could blame that on Fidel Castro and justify going to war, or sink one of our boats and blame it on Fidel Castro. He wrote about this. You can get it off the internet. We actually have it in one of our syllabuses. And of course, James Bovard written another book, Pretext for War. The government is monitoring his telephone calls. He's not a terrorist. They know he's not a terrorist. And when they say, well, you know, we're only after terrorists, ladies and gentlemen, that is simply to make you feel better. The truth of the matter is that they have targeted all sorts of people who would be enemies of the state. And when you do this, and when the president is allowed to violate the laws of our land, then no man's family or freedom or property are safe.
Amen.
All right, fine. Well, let's get back, of course, to discussing what's happening financially in the market. Certainly, the market really got up over 11,000. That was really a rather remarkable thing. Do you think it's going to stay up? Do you think it's going to keep going up? Do you think it's going to fall one of these days soon?
Well, the market is where it is because the working group in financial markets and the Federal Reserve wanted at that level.
And what you're basically saying is all manipulated by what you call the plunge protection team, but they have a fancy name for it.
Exactly. And that goes on every day, 24 hours a day. And they get thousands of employees, and that's all they do is rig markets.
But they're not supposed to do that. But didn't they pass some sort of an executive order that would allow them to rig the markets?
Well, the executive order, if you read it, says that in an emergency, the government can step in and do things to markets which will hopefully keep them from crashing. And that's not what they're doing. They're abusing it.
All right. Well, some people say that the market's going up because there's a tremendous liquidity. In other words, the government has created all this money. It's got to go someplace.
Well, that's true to an extent, but most of that money is going into the bond market.
Is that why the price of long-term bonds has been long, why we have the inversion between the long-term, short-term bond rates?
Sure is.
All right, we're going to be
it
back.
It also helps the Treasury finance their debt, too.
And, of course, keeping those prices down means that they don't have to pay so much interest. And if they can keep the interest rates down, why, of course, our massive deficits don't look quite so bad. We'll be back in just a moment here with Bob Chapman. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and our guest this evening is Bob Chapman. I think it's important people understand that when you have a fiat money system, you can create all the money you want to. It's like playing Monopoly, only, of course, you become the bank, and you just keep bringing in more and more and more Monopoly money. And as long as people will take it, why, the game goes on. Unfortunately, I've seen where Paul Volcker has been talking recently, and, of course, for those of you who don't know, Paul Volcker was formerly the chairman of the Federal Reserve System, and he's worried that all these other people who are playing this game throughout the world, in China and India and Europe and Asia, they may suddenly begin to worry whether this paper money, these bank entries, really have any value. Do you think that's why the price of gold and silver seem to be moving up so strongly?
Well, that would be called a flight to quality. And the only real money in the world, the quality, is gold. And so that's why professionals and very, very few of the public at this time are moving out of currencies and into gold. And so you're gonna see this continue at an ever greater rate. I expect that, and this is a conservative estimate, the gold will go to $3,500 an ounce. And I don't think there's any way they can stop it now. I think that they're pretty much out of whatever gold they want to sell or lease, and lease is tantamount to selling. Because what happens is someone goes to a gold bullion bank like J.P. Morgan Chase or Citibank or Goldman Sachs, and they say, we want to buy borrow $1 billion in gold for 6 months. And they call up XYZ Central Bank and say, look, we get an order for $1 billion worth of gold. Can you lend it to us so we can lend it to somebody else? And they probably will say yes if they've got it. And then the people who take that gold and lend it, relend it to, say, you and I, we would take that out and sell it. And that depresses the gold market, at least on a temporary basis. And we take that money and we go buy treasuries. Now, if we're paying, 3% interest for the money, off of the gold in this case, and we can go out and buy treasuries at 4.75%, then we can lock in a profit on the interest, and we can do that for sure by buying derivatives, which will protect you against any movement in the bonds that you buy. And so they call that a carry trade. And that's what's been going on in the market. And I think it's about over with. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult, if not impossible now, for the central banks, particularly the Fed and the U.S. Treasury, to continue to manipulate gold and silver. I think the game's over for them. And silver now is acting in the normal manner. It runs all over the place, and that's the way it should be. And, it'll be up $10 one day and down $4 the next and then down $6 the next and up $15 the next. And that's the way gold has always acted, particularly when it's in the bull market, which we are. I mean, this bull market started back in 2001. And so the formation of the market has been a long time coming. It isn't something that happened yesterday. Gold has moved from 252 up to approximately 542 the other day on the February
hold that,
month.
Hold that thought right there, Bob. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Bob Chapman is saying that he feels that we are really in a real bull market for gold, that the central banks really no longer have the gold that they can put out there to manipulate the gold price, because they've been manipulating the gold price already for decades. Why do they manipulate the gold price? Because they didn't want the average individual to have anything of any value to trade. And you have to have some means of exchange in society. And so that way we were forced to use their paper money that they could create out of nothing. And that is the most carefully kept secret in society today. And that is that banks create money out of nothing, the government and the Fed create money out of nothing, and of course, then of course it becomes a medium of exchange. But someday, sometime, why, the day of reckoning comes. And you think the day of reckoning is upon us, Bob?
I think it's already begun, and they know that. And they've deliberately caused that, just like they've caused the demise of the economies of the Western world, so to speak. And everything is going to continue to deteriorate, except the price of gold and silver, because they will use hyperinflation up to the point that they want to let the bottom drop out. And once that happens, you want to switch out of silver, because there won't be any inflation to speak of. Everything should be in gold, and even if gold comes off a little bit, it won't make any difference, because everything else is going to come off 70, 80, 90%. I mean, that's what happens in every depression. And because of the debt today, in all sectors, in all countries, because of that debt, this time it's going to be far more difficult than it was in the 1930s. And we also have a volatile social system today, which we're all aware of. And you're going to have people who have never had a bad day in their life saying to the government, look, you know, you did this to us. We demand that you supply us with a job or give us unemployment, you know, take care of the payments in our house and so on. And, of course, the government's going to say we're not going to do that. And that's when revolution begins. And we are going to have revolution in America if they can continue on the tack that they're at.
But, of course, they intend to actually continue on that tack. That's one reason why they've allowed all the illegal immigrants to come here, promised them all of these wonderful benefits. We've been doing everything we could to attract the illegal immigration so we would have a multicultural society, a multilingual society. And I really feel that the unfortunate people who are being lured into this country are going to be used as a revolutionary cadre without ever realizing they're being manipulated. And actually, as part of this overall program laid out by the Ford Foundation, which is financing the illegal immigration movement, and high government officials who are openly violating the laws of our land to encourage illegal immigration, refusing to enforce our immigration laws, moving us towards this period of chaos and crisis. Would that be a fair estimation?
I think it is. Did you notice that they just had a meeting in Mexico City of people from different Latin American countries, primarily Central America, demanding that the United States government doesn't put a fence up over part of the border, and demanding amnesty, and because, you know, the America owes it to them.
But of course,
they're
poor. The Mexicans
no,
are.
I'm all for helping the poor, but I mean, what they're doing, you know, the pro-immigration forces tell us is a misdemeanor. Well, I think it depends upon your interpretation of the law. I consider it a felony, and I think many other professionals do as well. But the point is, you can't reward people for breaking our laws. And beyond that, what they've allowed has created a tremendous disrespect for law and order and our court system. And then people have finally realized this, that there's two sets of justice, one for the wealthy and one for the poor. One article I saw today, they sent a gang member away who didn't have a record, incidentally, for selling 24 ounces of marijuana. And he happened to have a gun, but it was not evident during any of his transactions, nor when he was apprehended. They gave him 57 years. Now, that causes crime, because all of these other people who are doing that have weapons. When the police come, they're going to shoot them.
And, of course, one of the biggest problems is today that proportion to our population, we have more people in prison than communist China does. Now, they may have more people in prison, but proportional, we have far more than they do, because they have 1.25 billion people. We have over 2 million Americans in prison today. One of out of every three black men, a young black man, is in prison on parole or probation. What does that tell you about our system? We need to begin to get to a moral society, but we seem to have, the Supreme Court has outlawed any sort of morality. We couldn't even have the Ten Commandments posted in our schools today, because the children might actually read them and obey them. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Bob Chapman. We're really talking about what's happening financially to our country, and I really feel that we're seeing some very, very real problems. Now, our corporations are doing very well because so many of them have moved overseas where they can, of course, produce much, much cheaper, and then, of course, bring their products back here because there are no tariffs, sell them here. They're making great profits, but, of course, our labor force is gradually shrinking, isn't it, Bob?
It is, and that's why unemployment's 4%, because of a shrinkage in the labor force, and that's demographic in nature. But about 70 to 75% of the transactions between the United States and third world countries bringing in inexpensive or cheap goods is brokered by transnational American corporations. I think I'm the only newsletter that I've seen, and I read lots of them, that advocates a tariff system. The tariff system made America great. It was fair trade, and nations would agree with each other what they thought was doable and fair as far as tariffs were concerned to protect their own industries. Yes, it made things more expensive, but you know, you don't care how expensive things are if you don't have a job. And so I think the bill by Lindsey Graham, who's a Republican, and Mr. Sherman, who's a Democrat, who I really don't care for, but this is a good bill, a 27.5% tariff on Chinese goods, only I don't think they should limit it to Chinese goods. I think they should go after all of these nations that are manipulating their currencies. And if they don't like it, well, you know what I think they'll do probably is what the British did during the 1930s. They will freeze all the dollars out, or pounds in that case, that were outside the country. And that meant that people couldn't spend them. They lost their money. And that could happen again to foreigners.
In other words, you're saying that we would simply refuse to allow those dollars that are outside of America to be repatriated, and all of these people and all the central banks and all the governments holding dollars would find they're holding worthless pieces of paper?
Mm-hmm. And also, what they're doing outside the country now, and I've seen these bills outside the country, is they have a pinkish bill that they're circulating. And I've heard, you know, stories out of
Washington.
Hold that
call. We'll be back here in just a moment with Bob Chapman. Well, Bob is mentioning the very, very real possibility that one of the things that we could do, so we would not simply be deluged with paper, if other countries begin to lose confidence in the American dollar, is simply say, you can't spend your dollars here in the United States. We will have exchange controls, and you can't bring your money into this country, and Americans can't take their dollars out. And then you would have people all over the world holding literally trillions of dollars, either American dollars in bank entries or American dollars in currency, and you couldn't spend it. Who would want a currency that would be unredeemable in anything? And then Bob was saying something about that they're actually circulating bills overseas that actually look a little different. What was that about, Bob? I've never heard that
before.
Well,
they're a pinkish. Some people call them red, but they're really a pinkish bill.
In other words, they're still a greenback, though.
Yeah, they're still a greenback, but they have a different tint to them. And I've seen the bills. And on the other hand, what they might do in the United States is call in all the currency and just replace it. It could be one for one, or it could be, you'd have to turn in three or four or five old ones for one new one, which would be a devaluation. I don't know which way they're going to go on it, but that's what they got up their sleeve. And whether the foreigners get to take all the losses or we get to take them, remains to be seen. But you want to be out of dollars. If you're operating a business and you have to have them, you have to have them. There's nothing you can do about that. But if you have a lot of money, then you've got to be able to diversify into gold and silver-related assets, because none of the currencies are safe. at least not in my eyes. And so I don't think that people should stay long dollars or any other currency. And I think the risks each day grow greater that something's going to happen, because this system's coming down. I don't know when it's coming down, but it's in the process of doing so.
Well, now, what about the things like bonds? A lot of people say, well, you know, I'm safe because I'm in treasury bonds or I'm in municipal bonds, and certainly that's as solid as the government.
Well, that's untrue. And number one, municipal bonds have been failures before. They have them all the time. And most pension funds that are municipal, we would talk about city, state, county, back to municipals in one form or another. They're issued for a number of different reasons. And all of those are at risk because almost every municipality of one form or another in the country is on the edge of bankruptcy because of their pension plans, their pension commitments, as well as the medical commitments that they've made to retirees and people who are going to retire in the future.
Now, of course, the reason that they've made these promises is because the unions have organized, the unions of the government employees have organized, and put people into office who would give extra large benefits to government employees. But there is no thought to the future. Where is the money going to come from? And when you have enough people retired, retiring at 50, you know, at full pension, they've been in the police force, if you've been in the, you know, in the fire department, and it's really great as long as there's enough of a tax base to support that. But what happens when the tax base begins to fail and the municipality doesn't have the money to pay off all the pensions? Then what happens, Bob?
Well, then they go bankrupt. And that's why, coming back to the original question, that municipals are not bulletproof. And so you got to be very careful with them. Some states will get hurt far worse than others. But you got to be very, very careful with them. Government bonds are no panacea either. I believe and have for the last 5 years that inflation has been over 10% every year. The government's talked in terms of 2.5% and 3.5% and 4.5% over that period of time. And those figures just aren't right. They're bogus. They are what the government wants them to be. And the same is true with unemployment figures. And the government lies about just about everything. And the dumb American public, about half of them, put up with it. Half of them think it's okay to spy if it's for, you know, the war on terror. Yeah. There is no war on terror. It's a scam. It's just a pure scam to subjugate the American people. But they don't get it. Well, they'll get it when they're in the streets. They don't have anything to eat.
Well, I'm very, very concerned that you're absolutely right. I mean, we hear about how we're fighting terrorists over there in Iraq. No, we're fighting a lot of Iraqis who do not want the Americans there, who feel that we're there to disrupt their country, to steal their oil, and to become permanent occupiers. And how would the average American feel? You know, if the Chinese troops were occupying the United States after having toppled what they said was a corrupt federal government, there'd be tremendous resistance here. There are a very small percentage of Al-Qaeda terrorists there. There are a very small percentage of Ba'athists who support Saddam Hussein. But most of the insurgents there are neither Ba'athists nor Al-Qaeda. So why does the president call them terrorists? They are simply people who, mistakenly, they may very well be, I believe they're fighting an American occupation. And unfortunately, there are people there who are financing them, people like the PLO who are egging them on and financing them, and of course we're financing the PLO. And then there are people in Saudi Arabia who are egging them on and financing them, and we're helping the Saudis. And then there are people in Pakistan who are training terrorists, and who's financing Pakistan? Why we are. Massive financial support to all the people who are financing and training the insurgents. And you have to ask yourself, what's wrong with this picture? Well, let's get back to some of the things financial. What do you think is going to happen to silver? How high can that go? And how would you know when to get out of silver?
Well, first of all, I think $50 is very doable. The inventory problem in silver is colossal. And that just isn't going to change in any way. There's no way it can. And so one of these days, there just isn't going to be any inventory, and it'll move a dollar an ounce maybe 10 days in a row because there's no limits on silver. Back in the 78-81 period, they had limits every day as to what silver could go up or down. And sometimes you get a lock limit up 10 or 15 days in a row. And at 50 cents an ounce, 10 days in a row, that amounts to a big rise in prices. But silver is going to be absolutely explosive. And there's only a handful of silver stocks. There's only two large ones here in North America. And
what are those?
That would be Silver Standard and Pan American Silver. Of the two, I prefer Silver Standard. It's among one of my recommendations. But the other one's good, too, but I don't think it's quite as good as this one.
And they really haven't started to move yet, have they?
Not really. They've moved from a couple of dollars up to $15 to $20, but that's nothing. You know, two of the better gold stocks, like Agnico Eagle and Goldcorp, have moved from $5 and $6 up to $25 or so. It's nothing. You know, I've seen moves in stocks from 30 cents to $55 last time around. And the dynamics that are in place today are far greater than they were in 63, 68, 74, 78 to 81, 86. I mean, it was nothing. The problems were nothing compared to what they are today. And we talk about that all the time in the International Forecaster. I was a stockbroker specializing in gold and silver shares for 28 years. I retired 15 or 16 years ago. So I know a lot about that, and I've been involved in that whole venue, or this whole venue, for 46 years, so I got a lot of experience.
Well, before we go on, let's tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, how they can get a free copy of the International Forecaster, and perhaps determine whether or not they'd like to subscribe.
Well, they can call toll-free, and the number is 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For those of you who have the Internet, we have a site. That address is theinternationalforecaster.com. The International, F-O-R-E-C-A-S-T-E-R.com. And our email is international_, is like a dash, but it's lower down. It's like a line on the line. So it's international_forecaster@yahoo.com. And by any of those means, they can access me. But to get a free copy quickly, the best way is to call a toll-free number.
All right, fine. So you are very then bullish on silver, and you think that that has a good way to go. Could it go higher than 50? Could it go to 100? Some people talk about 100, 200. Is that just pie in the sky?
No, I think it's possible, because there's no inventory to speak of. And when you have hyperinflation, silver will go with gold because of the leverage situation due to lack of inventory. Silver's gains probably would be greater than gold. And on the other hand, when inflation ends and inflation diminuates, it goes down, then silver would too. So you're going to have to get out of silver at the top of the inflationary market. That's not true with gold, because gold will be a store of value. In other words, it'll go to a flight to quality after they've had hyperinflation regarding gold. And so that means if gold went to $3,500 an ounce during a depression, when everything went down 60 to 90%, gold might go down 10 or 15 or 20%. Big deal. I mean, you've got all your assets in place, and goodness gracious, on the way up, you probably made a heck of a lot of money. In fact, the subscribers to the Forecaster in the last 3 years have made hundreds of percent on coins and stocks that we've recommended. and they've just done enormously. In fact, we just traded out of a stock that we recommended at 40 cents at $1.60, and those are tremendous gains.
Well, now, of course, are we going to have deflation, or are we going to have hyperinflation? These are the questions, of course, that I think everybody's wondering. They're talking now about stopping raising the interest rates because they don't think inflation is such a factor, and they're trying to keep the economy going. As they've raised the rates, they slow down the economy. They say maybe one or two more rounds, and then they're going to stop doing that because they're not worried about inflation. They're worried about deflation. So what's going to happen?
First of all, they lie. And second of all, what are they going to do after they stop raising interest rates? They're going to let them go down again. So that's inflationary. But you get the forecaster every week, and you read the figures that I give on M3 and credit. And it's just gone absolutely bonkers in the last 9 months. In the last 2 weeks alone, M3 and bank credit, just those two entities, are up approximately $66 billion.
Now, what you're talking about
weeks.
Is...
I mean, it's incredible.
What you're saying is they're creating massive amounts of money to try to keep the economy going, but in the process, it's terribly inflationary.
And that's why you're going to have inflation. And they've got to take that route until they want to pull the plug. And they will do it when they want to do it.
Now, of course, one of the things is they're talking about stopping letting the people know what M3 is. In other words, this increment, this means by which you can tell what they're really doing behind the scenes. They're going to stop publishing M3 in March. About the same time, the Iranians are talking about stopping selling their oil in dollars. They're planning on beginning to dispose of their oil in the euro. Won't that have a tremendous impact on the stability of the dollar if countries begin turning away from the use of dollars and begin shifting to the euro? Or is this simply a lot of talk?
Oh, no, it's for real. It's one of the reasons we went into Iraq, because they were trading oil in euros, had been for a couple of years. And if they are able to open and function on the Iranian bourse, as it's called, then, after a fashion, perhaps several months or a year, the dollar will cease to be the world's reserve currency. The thing that holds dollars together in world trade is really oil. Dollars are really petrodollars. And the minute that stops, the game is over. And it's going to change the whole way of life of everybody in the world, particularly Americans, because Americans have had a tremendous advantage over everybody else because the dollar was the reserve currency. And now that they've had the heart ripped out of their manufacturing, only 10.6% of what we use is manufactured in the United States. Now, that's incredible.
It used to be that we had 50% of the manufacturing.
And it was about 30, 25 years ago.
Right. Well, we've got Roger calling from Henderson, Nevada. Hi, Roger. Do you have a question or comment?
Yeah, I just want to ask your guest there tonight. I just want to know, by buying $250 of silver each month, is that good protection for the financial wipeout that's going to occur?
I think that's a fine way to do it, if that's what you can afford. And how you would do that is, my preference would be to buy quarter bags of silver.
Mm-hmm.
That's called junk silver, and these are 90% silver coins, and they were minted prior to 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I would go about it, because I would take delivery,
mm-hmm.
because they are legal tender,
mm-hmm.
bags are getting hard to get,
mm-hmm.
and I think about 95% of all the silver that goes into and has gone into silver bags has been melted down. And I think silver bags are semi-numismatic. That's my personal opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a coin dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've been involved in coins since 1960.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not a total professional in it, but I'm pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was collecting silver coins before they stopped minting them in 64.
Mm-hmm.
So we made a lot of money doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the best way to go at that.
Okay, and also I have one more question before I go here. Also, when do you think our economy is going to collapse? Is it going to happen this year, or is this going to happen during next year, you think?
Well, it's going to evolve. It's already begun. And it's going to evolve over the next several years.
And, of course, the thing is that when we took down our tariffs, when we entered into the World Trade Treaty Organization and NAFTA and now CAFTA, why, we simply abandoned our manufacturing base. It's all leaving the country. Our jobs are leaving the country. And it's all planned that way. It is part of globalization. As America's wealth, then America's jobs are transferred to other countries. The whole idea is to impoverish the American people, Roger. Begin making plans for it.
All right. God bless.
Bye-bye.
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Bob Chapman. Bob, we got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Well, you always give me the good jobs. I think that one of the other events that's coming up in March that's very important, besides the opening of the Iranian bourse, if Iran still exists, because our president says he wants to bomb it into submission, and they'll use nuclear bombs, I can promise you, because they're not going to have the troops to send in there. But there's also the fact that the Federal Reserve has said on March the 13th that they're going to stop issuing what is called M3, and that's made up of a variety of monetary functions. And to put it in perspective, it's really money supply. And their excuse is that they're doing this because nobody uses it and it costs too much. Well, of course, that isn't true. But anyway, we'll be able to get the figures because we would be, it'll be more difficult, but we'll be able to dig them out. The point is that they've done this because they don't want you to know about all this money they're creating. And I've never seen monetary aggregate creation like I've seen in the last 9 months, but particularly in the last 2 weeks, they've gone absolutely mad. And so they're going to pump it up as much as they feel that they have to, and it's going to continue, and they really don't want anybody to know about it.
And so on one hand, they raise interest rates to control inflation. On the other hand, they flood our economy with money to create inflation. That's sort of paradoxical, isn't it?
That's right. It's just like interest rates. They've increased them 13 times in a row, and probably again for the 14th time in January. And there might be one or two after that, and probably will by June. And while they're raising interest rates ostensibly to contract the economy so that we won't have inflation, they're pouring momentous amounts of liquidity into the market.
And so on one hand,
one is the antithesis of the other,
right?
Just like you said.
Well, I think it's important that people understand we're living in difficult financial times, and it behooves us to understand and to try to warn others that there's no instance in all history where a nation has gone under a fiat money system, and that system has not eventually collapsed. Remember what Aristotle said? There's nothing wrong with a fiat money system as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. Bob Chapman, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Good night. God bless.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was just reminding Bob that Aristotle's statement, there's nothing wrong with the fiat money system as long as you have perfect authority and godlike wisdom in kings. And unfortunately, a fiat money system didn't work in ancient Greece. It didn't work in ancient Rome. It's been tried hundreds of times. It always fails. We have had the greatest ride of really any nation with tremendous prosperity, all made based upon money that is irredeemable, and really in nothing. And today, countries throughout the world are holding American dollars, and I fear that many of them are going to be very, very disappointed when they find that suddenly these dollars cannot be redeemed in anything, and you're going to see, I believe, chaos throughout the world, financial chaos, not only throughout the world, but right here in America. But should we be surprised? Is there any instance in all history where a nation has turned against God, where God has not eventually brought a punishment to that nation and withdrawn his blessing? And I fear that that is exactly what's going to happen to America. We have certainly had more prosperity and more freedom and a better life than any people ever recorded throughout all time. And in recent years, we've had the opportunity to buy all sorts of wonderful items for, you know, very little. Go down to Walmart and see all the wonderful things that you can buy there for, you know, just a pittance. But the day of reckoning is coming. The overall plan is to equalize the world. And it's said it very clearly in the Earth Charter, which is the official document, which will be the new Ten Commandments for the world, written by Mikhail Gorbachev and Marie Strong and Stephen Rockefeller, two multi-billionaires and a brutal communist dictator. And their plan is for the equitable distribution of wealth within nations and between nations. Within nations, that's socialism. Between nations, well, that means the impoverishment of the American people. If you have not read the Earth Charter, go up on the Internet, and you can pull it down if you don't have access to the Internet. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll send you a copy of the Earth Charter. You must read the Mein Kampf. This stresses the new spirituality that will be taught in our schools. Now, we cannot teach the gospel of Jesus Christ in our schools, but we are to teach a new spirituality. What is that new spirituality? Why, it is paganism, and behind that are the Luciferian forces which are ruling the world today. If you want a copy of the Earth Charter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to understand what's happening over in Iraq, you want to get our newsletter on Iraq, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927. Understand we're involved in a spiritual battle being played on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if this country does not have a great revival and turn back to God, we're going to lose America. We had a great revival in 1739, and it changed America forever. We had another great revival in the 1850s, and that was the second Great Awakening. Either we have a third Great Awakening, or America, as we've known it, will cease to exist and become simply a remembrance of things past. So please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have this on the line, Mr. Alfred Adask, and Alfred had really been our guest probably the first time about 10 days ago, filling in for Melody Morgan, and I was really so impressed by his discourse and the enthusiasm with which he spoke. I asked him to be our guest this evening, and we're going to talk about the concept of we are a republic. Now, we hear the president saying all the time about how America is a democracy, and I don't know if the president has just never read the Federalist Papers or read the Constitution, but there is no mention of the word democracy in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence or in the Bill of Rights or the Federalist Papers or the constitutions of any of our 50 states. Every one of them says that they are a republic. So why does the president say America is a democracy? And why does he want to bring democracy to the Middle East when Plato wrote in the Republic, democracies always deteriorate into despotism? And you can find that quotation in Bartlett's familiar quotation. So what is the difference between a republic and a democracy? Why are we trying to convince the American people the United States is a democracy? What's wrong with democracy? And why are we trying to bring democracy to the Middle East? And with that as the background, Alfred, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Hi, Stan. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, well, why don't you pick up the ball and run with it?
Well, what, you know, one of the surprising things, if people would, we are almost inundated on a daily basis. You listen to the news, and people are telling us how we are fighting for democracy, and how one value or another is good for our democracy or bad for our democracy, and you can't hardly get away from democracy. So far as I know, the last person to refer to this country as a Republican form or as a republic was John F. Kennedy, and he was shot, the last president. Since then, they have referred to it consistently as a democracy. Now, the problem with this is that Article 4, Section 4 of the Federal Constitution reads in part, it says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a Republican form of government. Doesn't say anything about guaranteeing a democracy, and as you said in the introduction, there is no requirement for a democracy. Instead, it says a Republican form of government. That's Article 4, Section 4 of the Federal Constitution. I'm down here in Texas, and down here in Texas, at Article 1 is the Bill of Rights, and Section 2 of the Bill of Rights says inherent political power, Republican form of government. That's the introduction, essentially, to this section. This is the Bill of Rights on the Texas Constitution. It says all political power is inherent in the people, and all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their benefit. The faith of the people of Texas stands pledged to the preservation of a Republican form of government, and subject to this limitation only, they have at all times the inalienable right to alter, reform, or abolish their government in such manner as they may think expedient. The Texas Constitution says you can do anything down here in Texas, change the Constitution any way you want, except you can never get rid of the Republican form of government. Nobody down here is even talking about it. Everybody says we've got a democracy. Something strange has happened, Dr. Stan.
And, of course, how did it happen? I think it's very important that you understand that if you control the media, you control the educational system, you control the political process, you can convince everybody we're a democracy, and we're not. It's all a lie. Well, Alfred, pick up the story.
Well, the problem where we began to get into trouble was with the 14th Amendment. Well, let's go even back to the beginning. in order to understand the significance of democracy, you've got to understand the concept of law forms, which are simply the hierarchy of authorities that exist in different political systems. For example, in the Holy Roman Empire that dominated Europe for, most of modern history post Christ, I suppose 1500 years or thereabouts, I'm not sure, but in that neighborhood, the law form is God number one, Pope number two, then you have the kings of the individual countries that comprise the Holy Roman Empire, France and Spain and Germany and Italy and so on, and then below the kings you had their governments, and below the governments you had the people. So we had a hierarchy. If you were at the bottom of the pecking order, you had to take orders from everybody. If you were at the top, you were at the top, you take orders from no one. And relative, this is just it's a pecking order. When the English law form, was established under Henry VIII, they threw the Pope out. And Henry said, we're going to have a new law form, and it's going to be God number one, King number two, then his government number three, and then the people number four. But in both of these law forms, the people were at the bottom, and in both law forms, they were even below the government, which were the agencies of the king. The reason the people were at the bottom was because it was perceived that only the king had the divine right of kings. Only the king received his sovereignty as an act of God, as an attribute, an endowment given by God. It's part of the reason why the kings were crowned. Their coronation took place in religious ceremonies. It's part of the reason they wore crowns to emulate the halos that are associated with the Christ and the saints in the Bible. And we see some evidence of this even in chess boards. Take a look at a classic chessboard, and the king will have a cross on top of his head. All the rest of the pieces on the chessboard, they aren't associated directly with God. And as a result, they can all be king. They can all be killed in the sense that they can be removed from the chessboard of life. This is an analogy to try to illustrate a point. The king alone is not subject to being killed. He can be captured. On the chessboard, you don't kill the king.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Alfred Adask, and he's made some very interesting points. He was simply pointing out that, the traditional form of government in the Holy Roman Empire was you started out with the Holy Roman Emperor, and then you had God, and then you had the kings of the various countries, and then, of course, you had their form of government. You had the people at the bottom of the pecking order. When they got to England, of course, Henry VIII wanted to keep marrying different women, which was, of course, not going along with the Catholic order, and so King Henry VIII threw out the traditional form of government, and he put God first, and then the king after that, and then the nobility, and the people were down at the bottom. But the point that Alfred is making, that the king was always sort of somebody who was certainly authorized to do what he was doing by God. And then carrying over to the analogy of the chessboard, where, you could never kill the king on a chessboard. You can kill everybody else on take them off, capture them, eliminate them, get off the chessboard, but you can't get rid of the king. And so often, even on the chessboard, why, if you look at the king, he has a cross on him. Of course, he gets his authority from God. At least this is the traditional way of thinking of it until we came to America. So pick up the story there, Alfred.
Here's what happens. We come up with the Declaration of Independence, which most people regard as simply a political statement. But it's not. It's a spiritual document. It is evidence that this country did not simply engage in a political revolution when we broke free from England. We engaged in an extraordinary spiritual revolution. And if you read the Declaration and you begin to think about it, you'll see second sentence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The average person reading that sentence today doesn't find it particularly remarkable. But it is the single most radical statement in at least 2,000 years of Western political history. It's the high water mark of the Protestant Reformation. When they said, when the founders said that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, they meant all men, including kings and even popes. This was a powerful, where previously the kings alone had the divine right of kings. The kings alone were chosen by God. All else were subjects because they did not have rights directly from God. The king. He was sovereign because he alone received his rights directly from God. When the founders in our country came out and they said, no, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are equally endowed by God with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In the chess game, you can't kill the king because he had the divine right of kings, including the unalienable right to life. You kill the rest of them because they were just subjects, but the king couldn't be touched because he was sovereign. In this country, when they declared that all men were created equal, all were endowed with those unalienable rights, all of a sudden, none of us could be arbitrarily deprived of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And the third sentence in the Declaration is at least as important as what I've just tried to describe. It says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The first half of that sentence is what I want to focus on. It describes the purpose of government as envisioned by Jefferson and Washington and Adams and Madison. They said that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. They're telling us the first order of business, the primary duty of government, is to secure these rights. Which rights? It's the third sentence. And it has to be talking about the God-given, unalienable rights that were first referenced in the immediately preceding sentence. It's telling us the founders, their vision of government, first order of business, secure those rights we got from God. Now, the important point is that when they declared all men to be equal, and to be equally endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, they elevated all men to the status of sovereigns. If we had a chessboard, all of a sudden the pawns would have little kings would have little crosses on their heads, as would the bishops and the rooks and the knights and the queen. All men were now endowed directly by God, and by virtue of that endowment, we were all elevated to the status of kings. And instead of having a pecking order that was king and then government and then people, we now had a situation where all of the people were elevated to the status of kings, and the government was still there below us. It was for this reason the government was intended in the American law form to be public servants. Not servants of the king in the sense of the singular king as they had over England, but they were intended to serve all of the people. And the business of government, first order of business, was to secure our God-given unalienable rights. This American law form, as envisioned in the Declaration of Independence, is God number one, the Creator. Man number two, not one man, all men. And number three, government. Government was now, instead of man's master, government was intended to be his servant. And that was the foundation for the claim that this would be the land of the free.
And that's why, of course, we were the city on the hill. We were the hope of all humanity. We were the one nation that everyone looked to for leadership to bring freedom to nations throughout the world. And how far we've strayed from that concept, because, of course, once we began changing this whole structure of government, and the president the other night said, you know, I was elected to protect the American people, and that's what I'm going to do. And actually, 46% of the American people see nothing wrong with the government spying on us in the name of protecting our freedom. That is a frightening figure. Certainly, 56% were against it, but 44% supported it. That's frightening to think that people do not see anything wrong with the government violating the laws, the president violating the laws, refusing to do what the legislature has told him to do. because he's there to protect us. Go ahead.
Here's the danger in democracy, and that's where we are now. This American law form that I just tried to describe to you, where we have God number one, the people number two, and government number three, unprecedented. The last time we saw anything comparable to that would have been in the time of judges in the Old Testament. Ever since then, Western society has been dominated by monarchies. We went from judges into the era of kings. The kings got their rights directly from God. All else were subjects, and that dominated Western society again since the time of judges in the Old Testament. When we got to where we said, hey, all men are created equal, and we are superior to government, we are only inferior to God, it was the high watermark. I think I already said this, but the high watermark of the Protestant Reformation. This was an extraordinary, not just a political reformation, it was a spiritual reformation. From the perspective of England, for example, who believed that the king was sovereign by virtue of having special spiritual endowment from God, the American Revolution was an act of blasphemy. It wasn't simply the colonists were getting uppity. The colonists, from the perspective of England, and perhaps even from the perspective of the Holy Roman Empire, we were blasphemous in that we denied the sovereignty of individual kings and the Pope and said, no, all men. Right? Where we run into the problem today with democracy is this. There's an old joke definition of democracy. Two wolves and a sheep voting on what to have for dinner. And we all know that the two wolves will vote to eat the sheep. But we assume that in democracy this is okay because of mathematics. Two is greater than one. The majority rules. And therefore the two can vote to eat the one, the two wolves can vote to eat the one sheep. It becomes a function of mathematics. But the reality of democracy is not about voting. You can vote in a Republican form of government. You can vote in a bunch of different forms of government. But in the democracy, the principle is not, the idea is not that everyone gets to vote. It's that everyone is bound by the vote, and you have no right to resist the will of the majority. What that means is this. When the two wolves vote to eat the sheep, they don't get to eat the sheep because two is greater than one. They get to eat the sheep because the sheep does not have the God-given, unalienable right to life. Under the Republican form of government, it doesn't matter if two wolves vote to eat the sheep or 200 million wolves vote to eat the sheep. So long as the sheep has not violated his covenant with God by committing a crime that you can find in the Bible, murder, for example, so long as the sheep hasn't violated his covenant with God, we may not deprive the sheep of his life. And it doesn't matter if, again, if there's two of us voting against the one sheep or 200 million. This is in this world, in this Republican form of government, where we recognize that each individual is endowed with certain unalienable rights from God. We can have a free country. You can be a free man. Your audience can be free men and women. Because government, no one can take things from you unless you have violated your covenant with God. They can't simply arbitrarily vote to remove that. Under the democracy, they can. And this is why the democracy, which is installed primarily under the New Deal, this is a function of Franklin Delano Roosevelt bringing us the New Deal and a national democracy. It's based on the idea that the people have no God-given unalienable rights. This is the reason why they are insisting on separation of church and state. They want to try to get the copies of the Ten Commandments out of the courthouses. They want to remove school prayer. They don't want the people associated with God. They want them to forget that they ever had a claim on their God-given rights, because if the people remember that, we can put government back in the toothpaste tube it crawled out of. It is the foundation for limited government. The notion that the rights flow from God lays the foundation for limited government.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Alfred Dask, and he's explaining the difference between a republic and a democracy. And certainly one of the best definitions I remember is the idea of the two wolves and negotiating with the sheep on what they're going to have for dinner. But in a republic, you have laws that say it's illegal to eat sheep, and besides that, all sheep will be armed. And under those circumstances, with armed sheep and laws against eating sheep, why, of course, the wolves are going to have to find some other source of dinner. So go ahead with your definition, because I think what you're saying is so true, Alfred. And I think what most people really don't understand is why they had to take God out of our schools. Why they had to take prayer and the Ten Commandments out? Because they were trying to break this covenant. Because if you could destroy the Christian foundation of this country, why, you could declare a dictatorship and we could go back to the form of government they had under the Holy Roman Empire, where the people were at the bottom of the pecking order and freedom as we know it no longer existed. And the system of government that they had under the Holy Roman Empire was that of feudalism. And that's just where we're headed today. Yep. Go ahead.
That's about the essence of it. The heart of the difference, the heart of the conflict that we're facing, is under the Republican form of government and under the principles of the Declaration of Independence, 1776, we each received our rights, our unalienable rights from God. You could have other rights. You might have civil rights, or you might have beneficial interests. You could have other things, but the big ones, the brass ring, the rights that really counted, they came to you from God.
And, of course, those were really the laws that were laid out in the first sentence of the Declaration of Independence. Nature's God and nature's law, the rights that came from them, they were really the rights that were described by a man named John Locke. And he wrote about, about this right to life, liberty, and property. He came up with this idea that we had to limit the power of government, because that's how men were going to be free. And, of course, Samuel Rutherford, who is a Scots theologian, had come up with this idea that all men were created equal, coming out of a book he had written called Lex Rex. The law is king. Lex, the law, Rex, the king. And he said, you know, all men are born in sin. All men are created equal. So why should the king have the right to laud it over the individual? And it was those ideas that came from John Locke William Blackstone and Samuel Rutherford that became the foundation of our country. They were all Christians, the people who were there at the time the Declaration of Independence was written, were well aware of the writings of Locke, were well aware of the writings of Rutherford, were well aware of the writings of William Blackstone, and they incorporated them into the founding document of this country. And the fact that most of our ministers don't know that, that most of our college professors don't know that, the fact that almost none of our politicians know it, or if they do, they're never going to admit it, and lastly, the fact that almost none of our citizens know that, simply reflects the organized effort that has been in place for many years to control what the American people think. So pick up the story there, please, Alfred.
Well, I think, again, what we touched on a little bit earlier, and it's important for people to understand that it is the concept of God-given rights that creates the limits in limited government. If you want limited government, you must accept the idea that some rights are given to all men by God. Because with the exception of God, what is there that government can't push around and dominate? It's only when we sit back and say that I have certain rights given by God.
Hold that thought just for a moment. We'll be right back.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Alfred was just saying that really, if we do not acknowledge that our rights come from God, then they obviously have to come from government. And when they come from government, what government gives, they can take away. America was unique because it was built upon the precept that our freedom comes from God. Where is that taught today? When is that acknowledged? Today, why, if we're told whatever the government does is perfectly legal, whatever the Supreme Court decrees becomes the law of our land, and that, of course, is not true at all. We have people in our Supreme Court who were placed there specifically to undermine the fabric of our society, to remove God and prayer and the Ten Commandments and anything righteous from our society, because they believe in a different God and a different type of spirituality, And, of course, the freedoms of our nation, in fact, Christianity, is under attack today and being coordinated by people in key positions in our government. So pick up from there, Alfred.
Well, the question first, we were talking about limited government being a function of God-given rights. Again, third sentence in the Declaration says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. They are telling us that the purpose of government is to secure our God-given rights, and they're telling us that government doesn't have the power to amend those rights, ignore those rights, modify the rights. What they're saying is whenever government encounters a man's God-given rights, government has to drop everything and say, we are here to defend those rights. That means they can't trespass on them. They can go no further. When they encounter those God-given rights, that is the limit for limited government. This is exactly why government loves democracy, because there are no limits. Government can do, under the modern form that we have, a representative democracy. It is presumed that once we elect someone to public office, that they sit there and speak in the capacity of almost an oracle on behalf of the people. Our representatives, our elected representatives, are presumed to somehow mystically know what everyone wants done in the body politic, the collective. And based on that, they can do anything they want unless 51% of the people jump up at the same time and say, whoa, whoa, we don't want that. That almost never happens. We've seen one example of it that I'm aware of, in particular at least, and that is government tried to take away the right to keep and bear arms. They've been working at it hard, and I don't doubt they'll try it a bunch more times. But they dropped it when the National Rifle Association and Gun Owners of America and different organizations like that stood up, and they got so many people organized that they actually forced some of these congressmen and senators out of office. And the government realized, all right, 51% wants to keep their guns. If 51% jump up, scream, and shout, we can stop the government. But that's a very rare situation. Mostly, government just sneaks those laws in. They work them a little at a time, they pass them, and we're so busy watching television, we don't even know what's going on. And so long as no one complains, it is presumed in this representative democracy that the government can do virtually anything it can get away with. It's in the Republican form where they sit back and say, no, it doesn't matter whether the people know or they don't know. Your job as government officials is to secure these God-given unalienable rights. You can't take any votes. You can't take any action that would deprive the people of their God-given rights. In the Republican form of government, we get limited government. In the democracy, we have unlimited government. And anyone who's followed it at all, you can see that's exactly what we've got. Right now, average man's paying something like 55% of his income into taxes. President Clinton was quoted back about 1994 as saying he estimated the next generation would be paying 80% of their income into taxes. How is this possible? It's possible because we have unlimited government under democracy. If you folks don't want unlimited government, if you would like to get back to freedom, the first thing you want to do is get yourself a copy of that Declaration of Independence and read it. And you'll begin to see, my God, you know, we celebrate the Declaration of Independence every single year, 4th of July. That's what it's all about. We are celebrating the principles in that document. The 4th of July, we go out, we some of us get intoxicated, we play baseball, and we go swimming. We watch the skyrockets and the fireworks. But I'm 60 years old, and I have yet to attend a 4th of July celebration where anybody bothered to read the Declaration of Independence and try to explain what it meant. It's not an accident. They don't want you to know.
So like the third stanza of the Star Spangled Banner, they never sing it anymore because it talks about God.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back in just a moment as we continue this fascinating analysis. You must understand, if you don't understand the foundations of your freedom, if you don't understand why America is different, if you don't understand our freedom comes from God, you're going to lose it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Alfred Adask, and we're talking about the difference between a republic and a democracy. And it was, this was John Quincy Adams who said, "The experience of all former ages has shown that of all human governments, democracy was the most unstable, fluctuating, and short-lived." And, of course, it was certainly James Madison who wrote very, very clearly that democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been incompatible with personal security and the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they are violent in their death. That comes from the 10th of the Federalist Papers, and when they teach the Federalist Papers in our universities today, they always delete that segment of the 10th of the Federalist Papers. Why? Because they want to convince us that we're not a republic, we're a democracy. You know, it was certainly Alexander Hamilton who said, "It has been observed that a pure democracy, if it were practicable, would be the most perfect of governments. Experience has proved that no position is more false than this. The ancient democracies in which the people themselves deliberated never possessed one good feature of government. Their very character was tyranny, their figure deformity." And until you understand that nobody ever referred to America as a democracy 50 years ago, and you go back and you read Charles Austin Beard and the historians of 50 years ago, why, nobody would suggest we were a democracy, but there's been an organized effort by the people who control our great tax-exempt foundations, you know, the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the Fords, the people of great wealth, who want to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., And after all, when all power is centralized in Washington, D.C., who's going to control that power? Why, the men who have enough money to buy the politicians. And ladies and gentlemen, we have in Washington, D.C. today the finest politicians that money could buy. And the great tragedy is you may find a few of them, you may put them away, but there will be others to take their place. As long as there's power there, it's going to be misused. And the whole secret of America was that our founding fathers, as Thomas Jefferson said so well, in matters of politics, speak not to me of confidence in men, but bind them down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution. They recognized that liberty and limited government were synonymous, that tyranny and total government were synonymous, and they gave us here in the United States, for the first time in all recorded history, hopefully not last, a republican form of government, where the power of government was to be limited by the chains of the Constitution, and men could actually be free. Well, Alfred, go ahead, pick up the story there.
I'll tell you, when you talk about we are the first country on the face of the earth to have a republican form of government, the American law form, so far as I know, was not emulated again in history up until just recently. And guess who's got a republican form of government right now?
Who?
Afghanistan. And the reason I say that is because I've read the Afghan constitution. They have roughly a republican form of government. We went over there supposedly to give them a democracy. All right, that's part of the deal. We're going to give them a democracy over in Afghanistan, and we're going to give the people of Iraq a democracy. We will never give the people of Iraq a democracy, because the people of Iraq are serious and sincere in their faith. I'm not a Muslim. I think they're making a mistake. I think that's the wrong faith, my opinion, but I absolutely respect the sincerity of their belief. They could never possibly accept a democracy, because the idea is we can vote on anything we want. And it doesn't matter what it says in the Quran. We'll just vote on it. We want to have our women running around in whatever out on the street? Let's take a vote. Allah doesn't count for anything. We can vote on it. That's the fundamental idea of democracy. It will never work in a Muslim country. And it's part of the reason why we're wasting our time and lives over in Iraq. We can't possibly get a democracy. And part of the evidence is read the Constitution of Afghanistan. The one that's been installed since we got in there declares in part that the Quran is the supreme law, and they can't pass any laws under the Constitution of Afghanistan which violate the Quran. Yeah, they have an opportunity to vote, but that's merely democratic process. It's not a democracy. The democracy denies the existence of God. It sees the collective as supreme and the government as the voice or servant of the collective. But the government winds up having virtually unlimited power. As long as 51% don't jump up and scream and shout at the same time, government can do anything it wants in a democracy. But in the Afghan, we supposedly gave them a democracy, but didn't happen. It's been limited in their constitution. And the same thing will happen in Iraq. They will pass a constitution there. I haven't read the current constitution, but I guarantee you it's going to tell people that first and foremost comes the Quran.
I think then, basically at least the constitution that they voted on said that, of course, that no law would be contrary to Sharia law, which, of course, is the law of the Quran.
Right.
So, I mean, all this talk about democracy, what we've really done is created an Islamic theocracy over there.
Not exactly. Again, the Republican form of government is not a theocracy.
Oh, no, the Republican form of government isn't a theocracy, but this is what we've created in, over there, because, of course, the mullahs are in key positions in the government, and they're going to carry out this Islamic law.
Yeah, you'll never get away from that influence over there unless you can talk the people of Iraq into giving up their Islamic faith. If you can convince them to become secularists and atheists rather than Muslims, then you can have a democracy.
Gee, maybe we ought to actually try to convert some of these people to Christianity. If we did, we wouldn't be having all the problems. In fact, there at Guantanamo, instead of chaining the people, putting them in blindfolds and put, hoods over their heads or earmuffs so they couldn't hear anything and couldn't see anything. And then when we took them out of their chains and they're being forced to kneel for long periods of time and put them back in their cells, maybe we should have been nice to them and give them a Bible instead of a Quran, and maybe we would have changed the hearts of men. But everything we're doing is not to change the hearts of men, but to, create hatred of America and Christianity, and, of course, to increase their faith in Allah as an alternative to the barbaric Christianity that they've witnessed.
They've seen what they regard. They see us as crusaders. They see this as a repeat of the Crusades from, 1300s, something like that, 800s. I'm not sure when the Crusades took place.
Well, the Crusades were from about 1100 up to about 1300, mm-hmm. Something like that.
Okay. Well, they tend to see it that way. They tend to see this in that light. But again, if you can't, and it illustrates there's a point in all of this, though, that's also important to recognize. Bill Clinton, when he was running for a re-election, his election in 92, his motto was, "It's the economy, stupid." Okay? And that was what he told everybody in his staff, and they had signs, "It's the economy, it's all about the money," is what he's talking about here. And insofar as they could paint George Bush Sr. as having done a bad job with the economy, Bill Clinton could get elected. And a lot of people are led to believe that in this society and in this world, the money is king. The money controls. But the truth of the matter is the most powerful force in the world is the people's faith. If you can make people understand that their relationship to God is being compromised, they will come at you with pitchforks, knives, forks, bottles, rocks, rockets, anything they've got. They will kill you, your wife, your children, and anything they can get their hands on. The people will sit back and they will allow the government to take their homes and their property and their children and their spouses and perhaps even their lives. But when they understand that their faith, their relationship to God, is being compromised, the people become violent and zealous to a degree that is simply impossible to deal with. If you can't kill them all, you might as well leave them alone, because you can't stop them. Government understands this. And the primary, in my opinion, the primary business of every new government is first and foremost to get control of the people's faith. If you can control their religion, you can keep them quiet. But if the time comes when the people say, "Wait a second, the government, you can take my wife and my kids and my home and even my life, but you mess with my faith and I'm coming for you," as when people are motivated by that, government is terrified. It's more powerful than money. It's the strongest force in the world. Problem is, most people have been dumbed down and narcotized to where they don't understand the threats to their faith that are being perpetrated by their own government. And as long as that's true, they'll just sit there and they'll complain when we have to raise taxes or change laws in a way that are contrary to our interests. They'll put up with it unless they see a spiritual foundation for the assault.
But I see,
that?
Alfred, the people here really don't see that. In other words, Christianity's been under attack, you know, for 50 years here in the United States. It's been under attack by our Supreme Court. It's been under attack by Hollywood. It's been under attack by the people who make our television. And we see that in this latest NBC spectacle of depravity called the Book of Daniel. But the people don't understand. There is really an organized conspiracy. I believe it's a conspiracy against God to destroy the faith of their people, and I think they're doing a pretty good job of it.
They've done a good job, but at the same time, we have seen the religious right begin to evolve in this country. And in some regards, they have been exploited, and they are sometimes, in my opinion, misguided. But the energy is absolutely there as more and more Christians in this country realize there's something wrong. They may not be able to put their finger on it. They're groping for an understanding, but they know something is wrong. And that energy, I'll bet you, just absolutely has to terrify the people in government that are trying to force this democracy down everyone's throat.
No, I think you're absolutely right here in America. I think they've done a pretty good job of destroying Christianity in Europe. There's a residual, certainly, in England, which was once a great Christian nation, 3 or 4% of the people go to church. Mm-hmm. You know, in France and Germany, why, you'd be lucky to get 3 or 4% of the people going to church. Here in America, why, we still have a majority. It's just that I believe that the reins of power within organized Christendom have been taken over by the enemies of freedom. They've been taken over by the enemies of Christianity. And people get up and talk about God bless you, and of course they know all the lingo. They can talk in Christianese, but of course they don't believe it. I think that you're absolutely right, though. They do fear that the American people will begin to learn what this is really all about. And of course, this is my contention, we're truly involved not in a political battle, not in a cultural battle, not even in an ideological battle, but in a spiritual battle that's being fought out on a political, ideological, and cultural battlefield. And once people can understand that, then they can begin to understand why the Supreme Court took God in prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our public schools and public places, and why we have the depravity in our television and our motion pictures and in our schools, and why starting in kindergarten we begin teaching our young people that homosexuality is perfectly all right, and of course it's not all right because it's an affront to God.
It's not just that would be the principal complaint with homosexuality, but you know, when the AIDS problem broke out in the 1980s, one of the things that happened is government passed special regulations that the insurance companies couldn't keep track of who had AIDS and who was dying from it. And as they said, this was being done to protect homosexuals from discrimination. All right, but the result was they don't have any accurate information on the life expectancy of homosexuals. It's not broken down by actuaries, and the actuaries in the insurance company, I don't doubt they can calculate the difference in life expectancy between the people who wear bow ties and the people who wear regular ties. But they can't track for homosexuality. However, you've probably seen this information. There have been a couple of doctors who have made their own surveys and calculated the life expectancy of homosexuals based on their analysis of death certificates and death notices and newspapers and so on. From what I understand, the surveys can be challenged because they don't have a huge sample to base their results on. Nevertheless, people I've talked to believe that the samples are they are achieving a result that's roughly correct, and it indicates that if you want to be homosexual, you're going to lose somewhere between 20 and 30 years of your life expectancy.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, how can our government tell us that they are concerned about the children of America when they are allowing books and magazines and television programs to essentially tell these kids that it's okay to be gay, when by making that what they say it's a lifestyle choice, but from my perspective, it's a death style choice. It's a form of Russian roulette. It's a form of suicide. It's a slow suicide, but it's a suicide nonetheless. If I went into a school and I tried to put posters up that advocated people smoke Marlboros, for example, or chew some of the chewing tobacco, everybody would say that's crazy, that's irresponsible. If those kids start smoking, they're going to lose maybe 10 years of their life on average. But they have no problem with putting books in those schools and movies and programs and, I suppose, philosophies, you could say, or system of values that allow kids and encourage them to embrace a death style that's going to shorten their life by 20 to 30 years. This is the kind of thing that has got to drive some, it should make some people just angry they can't hardly see straight. And it should even concern homosexuals. You take a homosexual, he's sitting back there, the government has encouraged him to engage in that lifestyle. They at minimum aren't giving them straight information, say, look, this is going to kill you. You understand? You're going to lose 20, 30 years of life if you want to practice this. If you want to make that choice, well, that's one thing, but you should at least have the information. Why won't government give the homosexuals that information? To some degree, you can argue that government is even by restricting this information, they are, in a sense, killing the homosexuals.
That's absolutely...
Now, I'm not here to speak on behalf of homosexuals, but I think you understand what I'm saying. They are encouraging our children to engage in a lifestyle that's lethal, and at the same time, the homosexuals themselves ought to be sitting back and say, wait a second, this thing's going to take 20 or 30 years off my life. Why didn't somebody tell me?
Well, I think, of course, I believe that there is a specific agenda. I believe there is a population control agenda. I believe, and of course we have any of our listeners out there who would like to see the documentation on this, something coming from Planned Parenthood, actually it was from Family Planning Perspective, which is Guttmacher Institute, a subdivision of Planned Parenthood, October of 1970. And on this page, and we'd be glad to send it to you, they're talking about how are we going to control the population. And, well, they said, well, why don't we encourage the marriage tax? That will, so it'll cost couples more to get married for their income tax is concerned and try to get women to work. And let's encourage homosexuality. Let's put something in the water to control fertility. And, of course, that's what fluoride's all about. They were planning this back in 1970, encouraging homosexuality. And, of course, back in 1970, most people would say that's crazy talk. Who would want to do that and would watch television today, see what they're teaching in our schools? Of course they want to encourage homosexuality, but why? Why? Because they're interested in population control. And as Alfred says, they die 30 years younger, and most of them don't have any children. Could anything be that crass and indifferent to human suffering? Because if you've ever seen patients with AIDS, it's a terrible disease. And if you really care about homosexuals, you're going to tell them the truth, because they're sure not going to get it from the government.
If you care about children, you're going to tell them the truth.
Right.
You know, the truth of the matter is children don't understand clearly what their sexuality is. The majority of them, I don't believe, they understand whether they're heterosexual or homosexual. They don't know when they're little kids. And they can be easily moved in one direction or the other. In a natural environment, they're going to certainly be moved to be heterosexual, and they're going to be happiest that way. But they're susceptible to picking up on this homosexual persuasion. And once they succumb to that, and you get diverted off on that track, I don't know whether they come back or how often they come back, but it is a dangerous and deadly road.
And of course, you may come back again, but by that time you will have diseases that you will never get rid of.
Maybe. It's absolutely irresponsible and criminal on behalf of our government to allow that kind of value choices to be made available to children who are too young to understand what the choice even means and tell them that it's just a lifestyle choice. You could be gay, you could be straight, it doesn't matter. It matters a lot.
That sure does. In the
right? It matters a lot. I mean, you could chew. It's safer to smoke tobacco than it is to be homosexual.
Well, our telephone number. Do you have a telephone number or website you'd like to get out, Alfred?
Yeah, they can. If they're curious, I've got some magazines they might want to take a look at, some other information at www.adask, A-D-A-S-K. That's my last name, adask.net.
That's at www.adask.net, adask.net. I will be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Charles Austin Beard, the senior historian in America during the first half of the 20th century, wrote this. At no time, at no place, in solemn convention assembled, though no chose agents, had the American people officially proclaimed that the United States to be a democracy. The Constitution did not contain the word or any word leading countenance to it, except possibly the mention of we the people in the preamble. When the Constitution was framed, no respectable person called himself a Democrat. And so if you read Plato's writings, he will tell you, democracy passes into despotism. Professor Alexander Tyler, writing back in 1787, wrote this, "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the majority of the voters discover they can vote themselves the largest from the public treasury. And from that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy and always followed by a dictatorship." That was written in 1787. Our founding fathers understood that. Professor Tyler taught it history at Oxford University. There's nothing new under the sun, other than the fact that the American people have been so dumbed down, they don't understand what's wrong with democracy. They don't understand that our leaders are trying to bring a system doomed to failure to Iraq and doomed to failure here. We've got about a minute for you to wrap up the program, Alfred.
Well, I just want to, let me tell for what it's worth, I'll give you a little self-promotion here. I'm the Constitution Party's candidate for United States Senator down here in Texas in the 2006 election, and we're going to try to bring this issue forward. It's not as if I expect I'm going to be elected, but we will try to make people aware of the difference between the democracy and the Republican form of government. And if you're listening to the program, you like this issue, get hold of a copy of the Declaration of Independence and read the second and third sentences.
And
I think you
express yourself very well. Of course, we'll want to get you on again onto our other programs. I think your message is important. And this is seminal to an understanding of America. We are not a democracy or a republic. And everybody who gets up and says we're a democracy is either illiterate or certainly they know exactly what they're doing and they're trying to deceive us. Alfred Adask, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It was my pleasure.
It's been an exciting time, and we'll certainly want to get you onto our program, our other stations, so that people can learn the difference between a republic and a democracy. And I think you do a beautiful job of laying it out.
Thanks very much.
Good night, and God bless you.
Good night.
All
God
right,
bless.
Fine. That was Alfred Adask. Hope you enjoyed. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and if you can go up to our webpage, and certainly at www.radioliberty.com, we have a number of newsletters there you can pick up. Our August 1999, September 1999 newsletters, and of course our November and December 2000 newsletters about democracies and republics. We recommend them to you. That's really November and December of 2000. Get those newsletters and read them and understand the difference between a republic and a democracy. And understand that there is an agenda behind what's going on today. If you have not yet read my newsletter, on the occult hierarchy. You need to get those newsletters, and of course you need to get my newsletter. It's called Deja Vu in Iraq. It goes into why the President of the United States keeps talking about wanting to bring democracy to the Middle East. Why do we want to bring a democracy to the Middle East when it will never work? It never has worked throughout time. Well, I think you'll be fascinated. If you'd like a free copy of our newsletter on Deja Vu in Iraq, just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'd be glad to send you a free copy of our newsletter. Please go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, and you can see about all of the various things we've written. Our newsletters are there. You're welcome to pull them down and copy them. You can hear our programs there 5 hours a day on the Internet now, 3 hours a day at radioliberty.com, and then you can always, of course, link to our other websites, the Genesis, GCNLive.com, AmericanNewsDebt.com, RBNLive.com, the newsletters, pardon me, the sites that do carry our Internet programs. Our programs are archived at radioliberty.com, our evening program, and at RBNLive.com. And then, of course, we certainly hope that you'll look at the various books and videos and audio tapes we carry, and anything that we've produced, you have our permission to copy and to get out. If you're listening on the Here's Help radio network, why we want to remind you, we do a program on the station you're listening to at 12:30 every Saturday. And your job is to tell others about our programs, to encourage them to listen 5 hours a day or as much time as they can. Listen to our archive programs at radioliberty.com and get educated. Understand the foundations of our freedom, because freedom is lost when good people are not involved in the process. And if you're not going to get involved now, who will? If you're not involved now, when will you bother to get involved? When it's too late? People are going to have to stand up, you know, on their feet now and say no, or may very well be on their knees soon saying yes. And, of course, there is no instance in all history where a nation has turned against God, and God has not withdrawn his support from that nation. Please pray for revival in America, because we will not regain our freedom unless there is a great revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.